This episode of See Here doesn't put out, man.
Welcome to episode 2 of the See Here podcast. This is the discussion about music-related films. So happy to be back. It's only been a month since we put the last episode online, but it feels so much longer than that. And I hope that both of you listeners out there have been waiting with bated breath for this new episode. So let me go around the table and introduce the trio, plus our special guest reviewer for this show. My name is Morris, and over in Korea we have Mr. Tim Merrill. Good morning, Tim. And
over, how are you?
Look, I'm all the better for hearing your dulcet tones. In the United States of America, in Chicago, Illinois, we have Ms. Wendy Freeman.
Hey, friends.
Ms. Double Page Spread herself. And over in the UK, a man who lives in a town that is quite apt with its name, considering the weather conditions over there, Mr. Bernard Stickwell. Good evening to you, Bernard.
Hello, everybody. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being had. Now, I believe that you had a particular love and affinity for the film that we're going to be discussing on this program, so we thought you'd be an apt fit. I should say we're discussing, ladies and gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains. This was Wendy's pick, but we'll talk about our feelings about that film in a few minutes. But Mr. Sticky, good to have you on board. And what's happening? You were going to be starting up a new podcast.
Morris, you shouldn't be mentioning that yet because.
I'll edit that bit out.
Nothing is set in stone. There are some plans, but the problem is that myself and the other fellow doing it were kind of both pretty lazy. And so we need to get on the horse and actually start riding it, you know?
So what you really need to do is get the enthusiasm for the first, you know, 2-3 episodes and then get lazy and sort of go online and, you know, sort of point the finger at any one particular podcast, but, you know, just say,
I can't
be fucked doing this episode. But, you know,
we have good intentions and hopefully this year we will, we'll get off our fat asses and do something about it.
Nice.
So, coming soon to an iPod near you, maybe.
To your ear holes.
I think someone uses that one already, don't they?
Oh, right.
I'm not sure.
Hang on, have they paid for the copyright?
There you go.
Maybe
I could do the coming in your ear holes cast.
Yeah. Coming in your ear holes. Oh, God. There we go. And so, Wendy, Tim, how are you guys? Wendy, you first. All well?
Oh, man. I'm just doing great.
What's new and exciting in your life?
Oh, nothing. You know, Double Page Spread chugs along, and yes. The Trashy Trio chugs along. just spending my days, God, I don't know.
Baking? Any baking going on, Wendy?
I have so much baking going on at all times. I made little coffee cakes the other day.
Yum.
For Valentine's Day, I made whoopie pies. They're like reverse cupcakes.
Reverse cupcakes? That sounds amazing.
What is a reverse cupcake?
Yeah. It's like two cakes with gush in the middle. It's great.
Gush.
Wow. Splooge. Has it got a splooge in the middle?
I would have thought that rather than calling it Wookiee cupcakes, you would have called, you know, great walking carpets or something like that.
No, they're whoopie pies.
Wookie pies, excuse me.
Whoopie.
I thought Wookie all this time. I kept on thinking it was something Star Wars related, which
no. Yeah, whoopie pies. They're like, you know, they're like a more portable cupcake.
Right.
That sounds like some type of nasty euphemism your parents would use when they want to get it on. It's like Does Daddy want some whoopie pies? Oh, Daddy wants his whoopie pie.
If you know, the husband wanted that euphemism, you'd say, hey, you want to go in the kitchen and make whoopie or something like that.
That's only something right. Like if you're on the Newlywed Show. That's
right.
It's like some awful 1970s euphemism.
Right, it. Right. Yeah, well, I wish
I had one thing to say to that, which is in the butt, Bob.
Right. Yeah. That's classic. That was classic.
Well, welcome out there to Silver and Gold, and we've descended into madness over here. So I think on that note, what we'll do is we'll go cut to a quick break and then clean our mouths out with soap, and we'll talk about the film of the day, which is, ladies and gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains, which I guess itself could be a euphemism for something. We'll come back in a moment and talk about that. You're listening to See Here. We'll be back in a moment.
As long as you're not getting a stain from a whoopie pie leaking out.
Trick or Treat Radio is a phantasmagorical spin kick straight through the heart of pop culture, navigated by the Deadites. We are the world's greatest electroshock band, we destroy monsters, we drink booze, and we win championship belts. If you're not listening to Trick or Treat Radio, here's a taste of what you've been missing.
There's three guarantees in life. What are they?
Death, taxes, and Trick or Treat Radio every Friday morning.
This is one of the most convoluted movies I've ever seen in my life.
I'm fucking trying, man.
Hey, hey, hey.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, hey, hey.
Oh, yeah.
It's like you took a shit on a pile of shit.
But you shit on him right. For liking what he likes.
Yeah, well, it's my job.
This podcast is now banned in Germany.
It's me, Giovanni Lombardo Radice.
Shut up. I call bullshit. I demand someone to bring me the face of Lindsay Lohan.
If I had genitals, I would definitely bang her.
Oh, wait. Is she a great big fan person?
You just hit the jackpot.
This is a weird movie, huh?
It had action. It had suspense. It had great characters. It had great acting.
I'm going to strangle you with my jockey shorts.
I don't like mobster movies.
All right, well, here's my take. You're a sick fuck.
Thank you. Now shut the fuck up and let me talk.
Have you ever seen 2001?
The okay. Box, right? The box and the monkey.
Available on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and trickortreatradio.com.
Arrivederci, douchebag.
You're fired.
I need the money.
Corinne Burns, what are you going to do?
My name is not Corinne Burns.
Oh, what is it?
It's third degree burn. I'm the lead singer and manager for The Stains.
And it has become clear to several thousand very young women, inspired by an unreported rock and roll band with see-through blouses and white stripes in their hair, that life is to be lived right now.
You are gonna be really good. Can't explain it.
What it really amounts to is girl dropouts who are using the media.
She said things that I've always wanted to say, and I haven't been able to.
We're the Stains, and we don't put out.
We weren't like that, were we, Brenda?
No, we weren't.
You are moving so fast. You're happening so fast. You can't afford to be loyal to this guy.
Why are you still hanging around here? Why don't you just go back to wherever it was you came from?
You've got a lot to learn, you little... Yeah, I want to see the world for free.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Fabulous Stains!
Call up, calling yourself in. The commies are coming, did I hear you say? Who cares, who knows, maybe I will one day.
Rhino Entertainment presents a Lou Adler film. Ladies and gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains. DVD and soundtrack now available.
Do you want to be a professional?
Oh,
Welcome back from break. You're listening to the See Here podcast. Morris here, Wendy there, Tim there, and our special guest, Mr. Bernie Sticky. Also there.
I do feel very special to be here. Thank you, guys.
So we're here to talk about, ladies and gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains. Do I go reading the IMDb review?
Yes, please. Right, give us a synopsis.
Okay, the synopsis. The media and disaffected teens mistake the acerbic... Is that how it's pronounced? Acerbic?
Acerbic.
There you go. I'm completely illiterate. I can read reading, but I can't read writing. Okay. The media and disaffected teens mistake the acerbic rants of an obnoxious teenage punk rocker as a rallying cry for the women of America, launching her and her talentless group to national stardom. I think that's actually quite a good summary.
Right.
I'm glad they emphasized the word talentless.
Right. Yes. Yes. I was going to bring that up in my my critique of them, but you know they've beaten me to the punch. So I think, you know, Wendy, this was your pick, so you start off and we'll just shoot you down in flames every time you say it's good or something like that.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, you know, it was hard for me to get past much in this movie aside from Paul Simonon. How do you say Paul, his last name? The guy from The Clash.
Simonon. Simonon.
This movie should Paul just Simonon. Be called Paul Simonon's Excellent Cheekbones. I don't think much else happened in the movie for me except for... the excellent bone structure of Paul Simonon.
I mean, you picked this. I thought this is a film you were madly in love with.
Oh, it is. I love this movie. I think it's a really, really good movie. I feel like it holds up very, very well today. And it's funny because, like, last time we were talking about how much I hated that documentary about Kathleen Hanna. And I feel like this predates that so much. This movie predates Riot Girl. It predates a lot of it. But it's so very, very... affecting and prescient of that type of stuff to come, you know? And it's so very much like she becomes this media superstar based on the video of her quitting her job. And we have stuff like that happens on YouTube all the time now, you know? Like, now we have all these ways of seeing people, disaffected people, blowing people off and, you know... Right. Being the voice of our own frustration, that type of thing.
Sure. Right. So just like something like the Truman Show, which went and predated so-called reality television. Go on.
I don't mean to interject here, but did anybody else get a little bit of a Network vibe off of this thing?
Oh yeah, yeah, that too. Definitely.
I hadn't thought about that. But yeah, I see it. Yeah, very good.
The interactions between the two anchors, the co-anchors. Yeah.
Right. And just the idea of the media darling.
Sorry, I was going to say that guy with the mustache was—he was a total wanker, basically.
Oh, hang on,
a real twat.
There you go, Tim. Yeah.
Well, hang on. So is that word actually sort of pronounced like the other way, Bernie? Is it wonker?
No.
Isn't
Morris,
he the guy that makes chocolate?
Or is it Willy Wanker in his chocolate factory?
Yeah.
I wouldn't eat Willy Wanker chocolate, I can tell you that right now.
He makes some whoopie pies.
Oh, gosh. All right, so anyway, let's give a... I've gone and read the IMDb summary, but Wendy, sort of run us through the early events of the film that lead to...
Just cut in quickly here?
Please,
sorry,
please.
This is very brief, but that first scene that you just mentioned where she quits her job... Did you guys notice who her boss was?
No.
Was it? It's Brent Spiner. It was Data from Star Trek The Next Generation.
I never got beyond Captain Kirk.
He had a mustache as well. It's pretty good.
I wanted to say something, too, before we get into the actual synopsis and looking at status moment by moment and get into the film. I wanted to say that... just for a second, the director, Lou Adler, I just wanted to say a couple of things about him. Actually, what's funny is it being a music film, he had a huge background in music because Lou Adler, the way I knew Lou Adler initially was through Cheech and Chong.
I was going to say, the first thing that I remember of Lou Adler was I had a 45 single years ago of Earache My Eye.
Right.
And his name was on that.
Well, he did more than he directed Up in Smoke, And also, he produced, like, so many artists, it's not even funny. I mean, you know, he produced Spirit, he produced Cheech and Chong, he produced Sam Cooke, he produced, like, so many people, it's not even funny. I mean, like, his directorial canon is not notable at all, really, because it's just Up in Smoke and the Fabulous Stains. But coming at it from a music background, you know, this guy was pretty renowned, I mean, for what he was involved in. So I think it's kind of interesting, if it was a director who really didn't have a musical background approaching this kind of material, it might have been quite different. But I mean, Adler, with what he had done in the past coming in, I think it was really notable and added to the film.
Well, look, it's interesting you bring that up, because I mean, I know we're going to maybe talk about this a little bit more further down the track once we sort of talk about developments in the film, but my take on this was less so much a film about a music group and more Hollywood's impression of, right, what's big out there? It's punk. And of course, they were 2 years too late, but oh yeah, punk is a thing. All right. Well, this is our perception of what the music scene is right. about. And we'll have this faux rebellion by the kids. And then, right. well, anyway, look, we'll take that further on.
But anyway, I remember I first saw this movie on late at night on like Night Flight or USA Up All Night or something.
Yeah.
It was one of those like weird sort of late night cable things.
Right.
And I just remember thinking, like, I had no idea why nobody had told me this movie existed. Like, I had no right. idea anything about it. And I thought it was really odd. And then, it wasn't on video for a long time, right? It wasn't on DVD.
Right, right. It wasn't. But I remember right. seeing this, they used to run this with a double bill of a Jodie Foster film called Foxes.
Yes, wow. yes.
That's great, I remember.
Right. And it was that, Foxes, or used to run it with Liquid Sky, or what was it? Debbie Harry, what was it? City, something city. It's like a noir film with Debbie Harry. Union City, I think it was called.
Yeah.
Right. Well, we used to have a channel, 79, that would run the late night movies, all night movies. So after you're done partying or stuff and you go home and finally settle into your cave, you know, they used to run these movies all night, and that's the first time I remember seeing The Stains.
Until Wendy brought this up, I actually hadn't even heard of the film, and then I sort of did the research and found out that it had lasted like precisely a week in the cinema, you know, in the States, probably never made its way down here, and it was not an easy film to find, so I didn't feel too bad about it. But
Why was it unavailable for so long? Was that some weird music rights thing, or was it...
I could think of. It had to be something about the music rights, maybe.
Right.
Yeah, I guess.
So let's talk about the musicians in this movie. Let's yes. talk about it. First of all, Fee Waybill of the Tubes playing the lead singer of what is basically Kiss.
Thank you, Wendy, because I'm watching Fee Waybill with all that makeup on his face, and the first thing I think of, he's taking the piss out of Paul Stanley. He looked completely Paul Stanley. And you know what, when I heard that Fee Waybill was in this, I thought, all right, I'm interested. I'm really, really interested, because as you may or may not know, I am a huge fan of the Tubes. And then I saw, oh my God, there's Vince Welnick as well. And Vince Welnick, his turn of, you know, just, it was like Silent Bob, or a drugged out Silent Bob. He was, you know, just, I just thought it was the funniest thing, you know, where Fee Waybill and Vince Welnick, they're playing with their band, the Metal Corpses, and, Vince Welnick, you know, standing there playing the guitar. And at the end of it, he's looking completely stoned, and he finishes off with this harmonica solo on this song that's completely inappropriate. It just absolutely,
right.
yeah. Now, the thing I wanted to say about, Fee Waybill after watching this is, what I'd love to see any other film that that Waybill has done. I think, you know, within certain role types, he'd be hysterical. I think he just had this natural, almost Spinal Tap feel about him.
He was fantastic in this, wasn't he? He really was.
I think the only other thing that I know he's been in, but it wasn't really acting, I believe, was he in Xanadu? I think the Tubes.
Yes,
were,
he is.
The Tubes.
Yeah,
were in Xanadu.
Yeah. Xanadu.
Yeah. Which, no, he really captured.
Yeah,
he really captured the excess, I think, in this film. He really captured the excess and just that whole, you know, where they were on their way out, that whole thing about the generation of glam was on its way out. And,
well, I think one of the themes of the film really is the old guard going out and the new replacing
right, that's
it.
What I'm,
the stains, what happens towards the end of the movie?
Yep.
It's like you know, suddenly they're not new anymore. They're the old guard and they're being shouted off. You know.
Yep.
Right.
So now, does Diane Lane ever age? Like, she's so wonderfully fresh-faced in this movie. She's so pretty. And she always, like, she still looks so great.
Yeah, but she doesn't look 15 years old anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, there were that moment with Diane Lane and Ray Winstone in the shower made me think, oh, hang on, has certain government agencies been called in? Surely this can't be legal.
Yeah, Laura Dern looks great. She's so, like, I really, really liked, I think they've picked the right actresses. I feel like all these girls had that sort of, like, smart-mouthed naivete to them, you know? Like,
right.
And also, they're from a shitty town in Pennsylvania, and I'm from a shitty town in Pennsylvania. I felt, I felt kinship to these girls, which I think is what you're supposed to, you know, but.
Right.
The one thing that, I just have to say this or I'm going to forget about it, was the whole look of Diane Ladd with her red makeup and her hair and everything. I mean, initially, the first thing that came out of my mind was Catwoman. Because, no, I don't mean Batman's Catwoman. I mean, like the Pistols Catwoman.
Yeah, it is. That's exactly right. Yeah.
Sue. I think her name was Sue, and not Susie Sue, but obviously. But I think her name was Sue. But
yeah,
I think it was
Sue Catwoman, wasn't it? Something like that. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And I think that's where that's the whole nod was to Catwoman. Yeah.
I'm just Sue Catwoman with two O's.
Right.
There you go. So
you guys know what I'm talking about, Morris?
No, I don't. No, I saw not the great Rock and Roll Swindle. I saw the Filth and the Fury. I sort of heard that there was all this thing about the great Rock and Roll Swindle was more about Malcolm McLaren's perspective of things, but the Filth and the Fury I found fascinating. Love that.
Sue Catwoman's in both of them, but I mean when you see her look, when you see the photograph, you'll say, oh shit, yeah, like that's it, that's exactly it.
I've just I'm just posting a picture of her in the Love That Album Facebook group, Morris.
Oh, good. Let me have a look.
There you go.
Spitting image.
Hang on.
I'm sure she was one of the people there at the infamous Sex Pistols Bill Grundy TV incident.
Right.
She was on the set when they were calling that guy, you fucker, you rotter.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, completely. Do you think she's wearing a see-through top just like Diane Lane does in the movie?
Yeah.
Probably.
Oh, dear.
I love how they kept telling you over and over she was wearing a see-through top, but they're way more into showing the other girls in see-through tops.
Like, yes.
They're very discreet with her. Like, they just wanted to tell you about how trashy she looked, but yeah,
there's one shot later on in the film where they're playing to that huge audience of skunks. And then the camera just pans down onto a kind of pair of boobs through a see-through top, and it just holds it for about 3 seconds. You know, not that I was paying super close attention or anything, but like you said, they do make a note of saying all the see-through tops constantly, and they showed it as well.
Did it give you the orn?
Anything gives me the orn, Tim.
Yeah.
Fucking hell.
Oh, fucking hell. Oh, I'd love got the home. Oh, got the home.
So yeah, the Sue Catwoman look was very obviously an influence on the stains.
Mm-hmm.
So at this stage, probably we've gone and discussed specific instances, but maybe for the benefit of those listening out there, sort of give it like a little bit of a story arc. We've gone and done the IMDb summary, but we should probably sort of like say, right, well, what happens? You know, we got the three major characters, Corinne, third degree burns, and her sister and her cousin, and they form this band. I love that line where they say, "Oh yeah, we've only had three rehearsals." Yeah, but they were three really long rehearsals. and they managed to get themselves on board a tour bus with these two other groups, the Metal Corpses and the Looters, which we should probably speak about the Looters in a couple of minutes. It's about, I guess, their adventures being as part of that tour and their position going from nothing to being media darlings.
Right. It's basically one of those, you know, famous circus comes to town stories.
Right.
Where there's so many bands that have actually evolved from this kind of scenario, and so many artists where, you know, people have come out of buttfuck nowhere and all of a sudden a tour comes through and they kind of have this epiphany, or they kind of have this kind of like the sky opens up and they see the possibilities of greater things to come, and they have to catch, you know, they catch a wave on this, you know, and they just ride it as far as they can ride it. And then eventually they find out that, as Zeppelin says, you know, everything that glitters is in gold, you know, it's just, it's not what they thought it was going to be.
Yeah, that's completely correct. I mean, without wanting to give away the ending, although I don't know whether we should or we shouldn't, but sort of as we find, I'm wondering whether the closing credits, the end, is supposed to be ironic or it's supposed to be the Hollywood ending.
Right.
It's interesting. I was going to, when we get to that stage, I was going to talk about the ending and what kind of message it gives for the movie as a whole.
It's not a great one, but then again, it could be.
It's not. It could be a little out of place, I think.
Well, all I can say is I was very, very pleased that they learned to play their instruments by the end of the movie. Like, that redeemed it. That redeemed it for me, because, you know, it's such a pet peeve of mine when women can't play well.
That's the thing. I guess, have we already gone and said that they were pretty awful musicians?
Yeah, they're awful. All right, so now I really, really have been itching to get into you guys' opinion on the moral crux of the movie when the Staines essentially become famous by stealing the Looters' song.
Right.
Did that make you dislike the girls?
If anything, it made me like them more, because I thought the Looters were kind of a bunch of dicks. Ray Winstone particularly.
Ray Winstone has a good line in being a dick.
Yeah, yeah, he's your go-to guy for sweary Cockney gits, I think. So,
right.
But no, if anything, it was just because, you know, Corinne had such a sort of nihilistic attitude, mm-hmm. and nothing mattered, and what could be more punk than stealing someone else's song and then saying,
right.
you know, essentially, fuck you, and doing a better job with it than the Looters did in the first place. So,
the funny thing I thought about the Looters as a whole with the band is that, you know, it's almost like this Spinal Tap thing where, you know, when Spinal Tap the movie came out, a lot of people were laughing, but then a lot of artists actually saw it and they said, that's not funny. That happened to us. That's our band, you know. And I think that, you know, when you see the guys fighting amongst themselves and you see all the pettiness and the shit and them getting fed up and winding up in parking lots in mid-America and stuff, I mean, like, whereas Diane Ladd and, you know, Diane Lane, you know, all that's, they're portraying a role. It's like Jonesy, you know, and Simon and, you know, and those guys, I mean, Cook, they really did that. Mm-hmm. I mean, like,
it's fairly similar to the Sex Pistols final
tour. The Pistols
tour,
American
it?
Tour. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's even, and I think they even note it, because on the front of the bus it says U.S. tour.
Yes.
And that was the same thing that the Pistols had on the front of their bus. I mean, when they went and played Texas and everything else. But no, I just thought it was kind of funny how the whole pissiness of the Looters, you know, where that was kind of more authentic to me, because I know that, you know, these guys are really legitimate musicians, as opposed to, you know, the kind of, you know, roles that, you know, the Staines were playing.
It's interesting with the Looters. I don't know, because I'm coming at this from a British point of view, but they sort of, my feeling towards British punk is that it was mainly about posturing, and it wasn't, and substance, and style, sorry, it wasn't about substance. Mm. And the looters do that perfectly. They're just a bunch of pissed off people, you know, raging against whatever they can rage against, but with no real substance to what they're doing. That's certainly how I interpreted it anyway.
Yeah,
sure, sure. But I think it's a real meta thing, too, because if you look at it, right, like, you know, there's those that'll argue that, you know, that eternal argument about, well, where did punk originate, you know, in the West, or did, I mean, well, in America, or
it was Japan.
It was Chinese, yeah.
No, yeah, right. No, but I meant,
century.
Hey, I'm getting into my cups here. Leave me alone, all right? But I mean, but I meant that, you know, the argument between, you know, whether it originated in England or America, but there's the whole thing about, so if you look at, like,
all you guys are missing the point. It originated in Brisbane with the Saints.
Right, exactly.
Coming at me all the time. You better think I lose my mind, 'cause I'm stranded.
Good point.
No, I was gonna say with, you know, it there's a meta thing, because if you really look at, like, Vivian Westwood and you look at Malcolm and them kind of, you know, mass marketing that whole anti-establishment punk ethos, you know, like, I mean, out of the Sex store. Yeah.
Well, and of course, McLaren got it all when he went and managed the New York Dolls for a while anyway,
right.
Didn't he?
Sure, so, sure, yeah. sure. But my point is the idea of, you know, that the whole mass marketed, packaged anarchy that you're talking about, Bernie, you know, like saying that there's the words and there's the kind of gestures, but there's nothing behind it.
Sure, yeah.
And then, you know, whereas Diane Lane, she sees it in, you know, Winstone, you know, and his whole, she, in the beginning when they come to her little podunk town, and, you know, and then he's almost like the Pied Piper, you know, with his band, and then he just draws her right along, and she doesn't even realize that it's, you know, just all a shtick.
Yeah, yeah. It's escape to her at that point, isn't
right,
it?
Right, exactly. It's her ticket out. And I also, before we continue any further, I would like to say that I want to comment on one of my favorite characters in the film, and the man who winds up taking the Stains to Babylon, my boss. He's the lawn boy.
You know, I really liked that scene outside the bus where she was just having that conversation with the lawn boy and he was explaining, you know, his whole Rasta culture and everything. Like, I enjoyed that. I liked the fact that this movie, once again, wasn't about, like, it wasn't like a love story. Like, there wasn't anything. I felt like it was sort of about her discovery, her self-awakening and you know, that sort of, teenage angst of learning your philosophy in life, you know?
Absolutely. Right. It's about her world opening up, isn't it? And her trying to find her place in it.
Well,
yeah.
Right.
What's the message that she gave? You know, she said, okay, I've worked out my place in life. I've worked out what the world is about, and it's dog eat dog, and I've got to do whatever I've got to do to get ahead. That's the philosophy. That's essentially what she's learned. I mean, remember that conversation where, Ray Winstone sort of finds out that once again, you know, he's down the bottom of the totem pole, and he goes into Seer and he says, you know what you've turned into? And she says, exactly. So that's that's what she's turned into. That's what her philosophy, that's what she's given into. That's her awakening.
Right.
Well, like I say, that's, you know, when you get to the end of the film, it's almost like it's kind of giving you a mixed message, isn't it? Is that the message? Well, obviously it's the message they wanted to put across, but does it work?
Like,
you know?
I feel like they became more authentic. I don't feel like they were selling out at the end. I feel like they're falling into their own authenticity. You know, I feel like I don't know. I kind of like the ending.
No, I.
So, yeah, I.
I
yeah.
Yeah, no, I don't. I mean, well, I
think I'd read it the other way, but
it's yeah. Is it ironic, or is it fairy tale? Is it what she wanted all along?
That's what
I think. Shoot that ending.
Apparently, an ending where her band becomes Ellen Aim and the Attackers, and then it just morphs in the streets of fire.
Well, I mean, to be fair, like really think about this as a kind of a perspective, okay? Look at like a band like the Go-Go's, right? Look at where they started, where they came from, and then look at what they became, like Vacation and everything else. I mean, like, you know, We Got the Beat. I mean, from where they started.
That's what I thought of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but I totally saw the Go-Go's and the Staines. I just saw that, like, and not just not just because they were solely women, but just that whole, like, when you really know where the Go-Go's came out of, you know, that whole scene, like, X and the Germs and all of that, and then to go into that clean cut, you know, like, you know, the music is still there, but they were completely, you know, like the 180.
So remind me, this film came out pre Go-Go's, didn't it?
Really?
I'm asking. I think it's because 82. So when were the Go-Go's? What, 83, 84, 85?
When they became, you know, a bit more airbrushed. I think they were around a bit before that, weren't they?
Right. I think they started about 80, 81, but that was just in the bar
scene.
It's part
of that whole kind of Hollywood scene, like you're talking about, because they used to hang out with the Germs and stuff, and Darby crashed in 81, didn't he, 82?
Right, right.
So I think this is actually post-Go-Go's, actually.
But it's interesting how there's a parallel there, and I mean, you know, it just kind of hit me when I was watching the film again, and I thought, yeah, that pretty much, and it sums up a lot. I mean, you know, here's a question to you guys. Is would you say that this film basically summarizes, you know, a kind of paradigm that a standard paradigm for so many bands that just, it, you know, this kind of paradigm, it's ageless. You know, this story could have taken place at any time. You know, it didn't necessarily have to take place.
Absolutely, because I think one of the things that makes it so timeless is when the Looters, when they point out to her, like, you're only famous right now because of a gimmick, you know? And it becomes that sort of deal of authenticity versus, you know, media stunts. And how much of that really builds you, you know, how much of that really will sustain your fan base.
Right. And you know what I thought was funny, too, and maybe, you know, it's just me, but, you know the famous last words that John Lydon had in the last Pistols.
Have you ever had the feeling you've been had?
You ever had the feeling you've been screwed, right?
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
Well, I thought, you know, when Ray Winstone is telling all the skunks, when he's kind of saying, look, you know, you're being fucked over and you don't even know it. You're paying for hair dye. You're paying for posters. You're paying for fucking stuffed skunks, like toy skunks. And this is,
see through,
you know,
tops as well. Don't forget
right,
the see through tops.
Yeah, don't forget the see through tops. Right. Of course, Bernie Ledger. But no.
Hey, wait, what?
No, but you know, this whole thing, I think, you know, that kind of plays on Lydon's statement too, you know.
He's pretty much channeling directly what Lydon said, isn't he?
Exactly. Yeah, big time. But here's a question too that I really hit me when I was watching this again last night. Would you really believe that all those girls would suddenly become enlightened immediately?
That's
because
I've got that as a note written down here. It took them a whole week or so from the time they were previously on television to accrue all this stuff, and then within seconds, like, this man who they can't stand by virtue of the fact that he's not Corinne Burns is telling them that they're twats or twats. And he's
twats.
Excuse me, thank you, Sticky. And all of a sudden, in seconds, rather than rebelling against him, or at least, you know, going home for a whole day and thinking about, oh, maybe he's right, inside seconds, they realize he's right. Yeah, absolutely. That was a part that I thought, oh, come on. But then again, it is a film, and we understand that you sometimes have to make that leap of faith for artistic reasons because they want to push everything into a 90-minute film.
Sure.
You know what I was thinking about during that scene?
No, what was that?
It was kind of the, you know, when you get the mob in The Simpsons and that kind of mob mentality, they'll just that mass thing where they all just decide to go and do something else.
Oh, the famous.
Somebody says, let's go and burn down the, you know, the windmill or whatever. And yeah. They do. So, yeah.
Right.
Actually,
I was going to...
No, go on.
I was going to say, the one thing I wanted to talk about, not to derail our current thread here, but coming into my mind was the one thing that I like about the film, too, is there's a moment where Ray Winstone takes Diane... And he takes her into to meet his manager, and there's a band playing, Black Randy and the Metro Squad.
Man, the first time I saw this movie, my jaw almost hit the floor when I saw that. I couldn't believe Black Randy and the Metro Squad was in it. Amazing.
What, right. A real band?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And, I mean, they put out one album, and it's an amazing album. It's called, like, the name of the album is Past the Dust, I think, on Bowie. And it's awesome. I mean, like, and it's a really sad story because Black Randy was this dude who was a really quirky character who wound up eventually passing to the, he succumbed to drugs. But that skinny, weird looking guy with the glasses bouncing around. Yeah, he was, that was Black Randy. But it's a really funny.
As well, when he's, comes in the room dressed as like a Mexican guy with the sombrero.
I was wondering who that was.
They had played in Los Angeles. They'd done multiple gigs, but he was a guy who was a real character that just kind of popped up out of the ground. And unfortunately, he succumbed to narcotics, like many people did. But it's really ironic that out of all the bands that are in the film, that's the only legitimate band, and that he actually, you know, like he shows up later where he comes in as the Mexican Randy.
And kind of gets shit canned both times, doesn't he?
Right. And here's a real funny thing too that I don't know if you guys noticed either, a little geek moment too. You know, Ray Winstone's manager. Do you ever see his face in any other films?
He was Miles Drentel in 30-something. I'm showing myself as a late 80s, early 90s TV nerd there.
Right.
He was Michael and Elliot's boss at the ad agency.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And he was in The Thing.
He was in The Thing. Yeah.
Yeah. You know that famous line, you got to be fucking kidding me.
God, I'm trying to think of his name.
Oh, shit, yeah, now. No, but that was, as soon as I saw his face, I went, yeah, man, that's the guy in The Thing.
Yeah, he's got one of those faces. He's been in loads
Niles?
Of years.
Niles?
David Clennon. There you go, that's his name.
David Clennon, yeah, but I knew him immediately as soon as I saw him. I thought, man, yeah, he was in The Thing. So let's get into the ending of the film. Let's continue to talk about this for just a little bit. I mean, about this idea that, you know, not to spoil, but after the kind of fiasco that the Staines go through, where, you know, their kind of fan base rebels against them,
that reminded me a bit of, that had a bit of a touch of the Tommy about it.
Right. Sure, sure.
Waiting for that audience to start singing, we're not going to take it.
Right. And there was also, you know, kind of a Ziggy Stardust, you know, until they killed the man, you know, it's like, you know.
Yeah.
It's that whole bringing a rise and fall in one fell swoop. Like I said, like fireworks, you know, they burn hard and they burn bright and they go up and everybody oohs and ahs and then they're gone. But the ending, you know, where they kind of present this, you know, you don't know if it's a possibility or if it's fact or you really don't know. It's just kind of like a scenario. And
well, I'll tell you how I took it was that they were essentially doing what they were told. Obviously, they were doing it in a different way to at the start where, you know, Corinne's working in that shitty burger joint and she's doing what she's told there. And then now at the end, they've gone through the whole kind of rebellion thing and being themselves and so on, and they just wind up doing what they're told for some big corporate record company shooting videos and, you know, kind of blanding out their music for mass consumption.
So it's kind of like a Dante's Inferno, where they reach another level.
You wish for, I guess. Yeah.
Another level of compliance.
I refuse to believe they're blanded out. I think they actually just. I think they, you know, they actually learn to play instruments, and they're more accessible. I'm down with that.
Right.
Okay.
In what amount of time, Wendy? I mean, you know, they were on the road, and they say, right, we're going to take a good 5-6 years off to learn how to really play our instruments.
Yeah. Or did they? Was it like a Milli Vanilli scenario, you know?
Right.
Right. Surely you're not suggesting that during the 80s people mimed on stage to...
Oh, no, of course not. Surely not.
Right. But, you know, I wonder if the film, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, Adler had his own way about, you know, thinking about approaching the material, but I wonder in the end, you know, if they, you know, would have benefited from showing an alternate where, you know, Corinne's pregnant or the other two are working in like a gas station or they're working, you know, like, I mean, just to show the alternate where it's kind of like, well, did they go this way or did they go that way, you know?
No, I guess I'm glad of the happy ending. I'm happy for the happy ending. I'm all right with that.
Well, but you don't know if it is a happy ending.
That's the thing. You don't know if it is.
It was a cynical ending. We don't know. I'd like to think that it's a cynical ending, because if that's the happy ending, then that's really where the 80s were.
I'm with Morris on this. They did. They reshot the ending, apparently, because I guess test audiences didn't like the original ending.
What was the original ending?
I don't know. I don't know what the original ending was, but I'm just looking on IMDb.
I'm guessing it probably was like she's pregnant and they're all working at gas stations.
It probably was.
Mm-hmm. Or
probably what happened was Corinne went and said to the Ray Winstone character, "I love you. Let's go back to England and settle down in and watch EastEnders every night." And
yeah, that's a surefire way to ruin
it. Or I think when
that
he says
your life.
Yeah, I think the original ending was probably where he said get on the bus and she said okay.
Yeah, no, I think it was. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't even know if it was that, because it said they had to reshoot the ending, and Laura Dern is noticeably taller in that last shot than she is in the rest of the movie. So she'd obviously grown like a couple of inches in the meantime.
Right.
So any other we haven't said anything about the media circus side of it. We've talked a lot about the band and about the interactions between the Looters and Corinne, but we sort of haven't spoken the Fox News type media commentators, and you know these very people who are you got the guy on the side with the loaf mustache on the one hand, who's saying, "I don't understand this. This is completely unmusical."
And the
woman on the other side who thinks that she's supporting feminism, but is, you know, really as well supporting bad musicianship. But
yes,
right. I mean, go on.
I think one thing that really sticks out in the whole film, in terms of all of it, is that, you know, there's this whole kind of inauthenticity in all of it, where these people are coming across as really convicted and standing behind what they believe, but they're only using it as a platform to get to the next level. Whereas, I mean, like with this journalist, where she's really seeming like she's authentic in the beginning and she's really compassionate towards the girls and their movement and everything else. And then when you find out in the end where, you know, Corinne goes into the TV studio and Buddy's like, "Well, you know, she doesn't work for us anymore. She's working for the National now," and blah, 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 where she's used the entire movement to basically just propel herself to the next level.
Yeah, it was just a stepping stone, wasn't it? For her.
Right, exactly. Right. And so she used...
She's not your stepping stone. I see what you've done there.
Yeah, there you go. She's used it, and I mean, just like, you know, I mean, the whole industry, all of it is about, you know, getting, you know, it's about Right, exactly. Yeah. People being used and people being stepped on, and however it gets you to the next stage, you know, I mean, and then, you know, and I think that's the initial core of the whole film, is it's about regardless, you know, regardless of where you're coming from, like whether it's journalism or music or promotion or any of it, I think the whole thing is about, you know, who is disposable and what gets thrown to the wayside. And I think honestly the only one that's really straight up and legitimate again is Dylan Boy, because he talks about but he wants to help out his mate, because he's trying to get money together to get his buddy out of the bunk.
Yes.
Right? And so, you know, and in the end, you know, I mean, you know, Diane Lane's character, she says, okay, here's the money. Here, I'm going to take this money that I basically, like, just, you know, had to put a knife up to the promoter's neck to get the money. Here's the money to get your boy out of the jail, you know?
And I find it interesting how after that conversation that she originally had with the Ray Winstone character, and she still feels, you know, pretty cold and heartless towards him, but yet she realizes that Vaughn Boy's intentions were true, and that's where her conscience bugs her. And so for just a few minutes she comes out of that sort of narcissistic side of, you know, get ahead at any cost, and she realizes that she's got to do the right thing by him, because he is the one whose intentions are pure, not the looters, not the metal corpses before them, but yeah, he's the only genuine one,
isn't he? Yeah, you're absolutely right there. Yeah,
he's the moral compass. He's definitely the moral compass.
All right, any final thoughts? I guess the thing is to, you know, for those people out there who've been listening to this and wondering, well, but, you know, do I watch this or don't I watch this? Would this be a recommend from all of you?
Absolutely.
Sure.
Yeah, I think it's a great movie. I really, really like it.
I was going to say, like, if at the time, you know, when this film came out, there was nothing really, established in terms of, like Wendy said earlier, the Riot Girl movement, all of that. I mean, this film predated all of it. So, I mean, it's very interesting to watch it in this current day and age where, you know, with Kathleen Hanna and Tegan and Sarah and all of the whole thing, that everything that's come after it, it's very interesting to look at it now. And I mean,
as Wendy said, it's very prescient in a lot of ways, the whole kind of media thing, the you know, reality TV thing as
exactly.
well.
Exactly. And I mean, you know, right, the media manipulation, you know, social manipulation, but I think also in terms of, the whole feminist empowerment thing, and, you know, the legitimacy of all of it. I mean, it's very interesting to me how you can look at this, maybe look back and recollect when you saw it the first time, or for younger viewers, they can watch it and just say, wow, like, you know, like nothing has changed, or like, you know, this is kind of like pointing out where
things repeats, isn't it?
Right. This film points at where it's going to go, its eventual outcome, you know.
A thought that popped into my head just now was over the film that I was speaking about with Zom on Love That Album maybe a year or so ago, which was Stardust, and very much the David Essex character. I think his path follows a similar sort of thing, maybe not obviously about female empowerment, but this guy who, you know, looks like he was in for the rock and roll, but really his agenda was something a bit more cynical, a bit more different all along the way. So I sort of see even a parallel that this story had been told in a similar fashion, you know, maybe, you know, 9-10 years before. But really, I guess, you know, this story is as old as storytelling can be. Doesn't matter what the media is, whether it's something modern, you know, mass communicated via television or records, or, you know, something completely older than that. I think it's still, you know, it's a very old story of manipulation, whether it's by media or by some other ways.
Right.
See, sorry, Morris, to butt in, can I just add one more thing quickly?
Oh, please, please do.
Yeah, yeah, sorry, just a quick thing. There's a point where Ray Winston is talking with, you know, Corinne, and he says, all you are is you're a pair of white stripes, referring to her hair. So do you think this is where they got their name from?
I think the film was ahead of its time. He could predict what was going to happen.
Well, you, yeah. You think talentless women. The white stripes are the first thing that should come.
Whoa, hey, no.
Oh, no.
Actually, yeah, being a drummer, Wendy, you are more than qualified to make that judgment call, aren't you?
Meg White is the only like glass house that I have every right to throw stones at, I think.
I think you're right. But do you think they got it from this? Was that a coincidence? Or
It's hard to say.
I don't know. Put a message on Megan Jack's Facebook page and ask him.
Jack's spent his career kind of ripping other people off, pretty much, hasn't he? So,
and that follows the path of this film. He treats it as his Bible.
There you go.
Good Lord.
and they were fly, you know, the white stripes. They're definitely a gimmick.
Yeah. Oh heck yeah!
All right. Anyway, we'll be back in a moment. We'll wrap up and speak about what we're going to talk on the next episode of See Here. You're listening to See Here.
Eight, seven, six, five, four, three, two, one.
Bet you thought something big was coming up. This is Terry Frost, and I want to tell you about my new podcast, The Martian Drive-In. In the podcast, me and a guest will look at obscure but interesting speculative fiction movies, the ones that don't get enough love, the obscure movies that you catch late at night you can't remember the name of, but you really like them. You can go to marsdrivein.blogspot.com or subscribe to the Paleo Cinema feed in iTunes. The Martian Drive-In Podcast. Watching the skies since 2012.
Hey, this is the ghost of the King of Comics, Jack Kirby. When I'm not haunting Stan Lee, I'm listening to my favorite comic book podcast, Double Page Spread. Each week, Wendy Freeman talks to creators like Cullen Bunn, Mark Waid, Evan Dorkin, and more. She is one cool dame who knows a lot about comics. So when I'm at my drawing board in heaven cranking out Fourth World Pages, I'm listening to Double Page Spread, available on iTunes, Libsyn, and the Stitcher Network.
And we're back from break. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of See Here. Just a little bit of housekeeping if you wish to contact us. We have a Facebook page, just, I guess, like every other individual in the world does. So you can look us up on Facebook, See Here Podcast, or is it See Here? I don't remember. If you want to send us an email, send the email to seeherepodcast@gmail.com. You want to make some suggestions for future movies that we should cover? We'd love that. Please let your friends know that we exist. It's early days yet, so maybe not all the intended audience knows, but I would like to hope that there are people out there who love their rock and roll and or love their music and love their films, and we think it's a good match. So please feel free to let people know that this podcast exists if you've enjoyed it, and if you haven't enjoyed it, please let people know because they may have better taste than you. All right, so next time is my choice, and we're going for a film which I actually haven't watched but I have wanted to watch for a while. And I figured this is a good excuse as any. It's the Robert Altman film from 2006, A Prairie Home Companion.
Oh, I haven't seen that either.
Ah, well, Tim?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the one about, I'm trying to think of his name now, Garrison Keillor.
Correct. That's
who did public radio, PBS, where his short story is The Prairie Home Companion, I think.
Man, Garrison Keillor is such a mouth breather. Am I right? He's always breathing through his mouth. Drives me nuts.
And he always talks like this, where he's got this thing about blah, 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 blah. We ate a pecan pie, and it was very good pecan pie, because it went with some aromatic coffee at Ethel's Lounge, and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, yeah.
Save this for the next episode. We gotta save this.
Yeah.
So if, yeah. If you want to hear more of that, tune into the next episode of See Here. As I said, this is a monthly podcast. So it's a few weeks yet, but tell your friends. And you get to hear Tim do that all over again. He'll probably start off the show with that if we're really, really lucky.
I just want to say thank you to everyone out there that's really tuning in and listening. And I mean, you know, we want to cover all aspects of music, and we welcome all suggestions. And there's a lot of films out there that we might have not even considered. And we depend on you, our listeners, to provide us with kind of input, and that it'll really help us out in figuring out where to go. And I mean, we don't really have a roadmap. We just basically, we're taking it wherever it takes us, wherever, you know, we kind of ride a wave, and we'll take it, we'll ride it out to its conclusion. So I would just like to say thank you for whoever is tuning in, wherever you may be. Thanks.
Absolutely. I second that emotion.
Yes, thirded.
Thirded. And Bernie, I want to give
I'm
a
guest
thank
this
you.
Week, but I will fourth it as well for you
yes,
guys.
Indeed.
Right. And thank you, Bernie.
Bernie!
Hey,
Bernie.
It's been an absolute pleasure. An absolute pleasure. If you guys ever want me back, I'm ready, willing, and able. Just give me a call, all right?
I mean, I really enjoyed just closing my eyes and pretending I was talking about movies with Statham.
Well, you know, Wendy, perhaps one day we can make that happen for you.
Right. No, thank you, Bernie, for jumping in on this episode, because you really gave us all the orange.
Oh, well, you know, it's just a natural effect I have on people. So
can we all have like a round chorus? Just imagine that we're listening to Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata and we're singing, I've got the horn, he's got the horn. I don't know. Wendy, have you heard any of the Derek and Clive stuff?
No, I have not.
Oh, you don't know.
Me too.
Dudley Moore and Peter Cook when they're alter egos.
I mean, I'm familiar. I saw Bedazzled, or not Bedazzled. What the fuck?
Yeah, it is Bedazzled.
That's Bedazzled. Yeah. You know, I'm familiar, but I'm not deeply familiar.
We'll send you something.
You gotta get deep, Wendy.
To give you an idea, Derek and Clive is a sort of thing that Zom would listen to and say, "That's filthy." So, you know what you're up for.
Right.
Anyway, all right. Thanks very much, all you listeners out there, or however many of you there are. And we'll be back in a month to talk about A Prairie Home Companion on See Here Podcast. Until then, be nice to each other. Cheers.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.